Hello, everyone, and welcome to Making a Difference in Mental Health Show podcast with your host, Counselor Prince Ofe. The main purpose of this show is to help every listener of this podcast understand how important our mental health is and to address everything you need to know about mental health, mental disorders, psychology, and general well-being. This episode 36 is a special interview with Mira Duncan on the topic Understanding Bipolar Disorder and How to Treat It. Mira Duncan is one of the board of directors of two major associations in Canada. One has to do with the Association of Counseling Therapy of Alberta, and then the second one is the Federation of Associations of Counseling Therapists in Alberta. Mira Duncan is also into private practice, and she's been into it for some years now. The name of her private practice is Third Eye Hypnotherapy Clinic, and is based in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Interestingly, in 2022, which is just last year, Mira Duncan was nominated and awarded an honorary doctorate of advanced studies in psychology for her research and work with bipolar disorder. Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's special interview. My guest is Dr. Mira Duncan. Dr. Mira Duncan is actually not a stranger to our podcast show. The reason being that we had her last year, I think, and she helped us to discuss all about environmental stress targeted therapy, which happens to be her own groundbreaking research work anyway. And I'm so excited to have her on board this time again. Dr. Mira Duncan is a registered clinical counseling hypnotherapist. She's also an international speaker, addictions counselor, lecturer, and author. She's from Canada. One interesting thing about her is that she's the founder of Environmental Stress Targeted Therapy, which happens to be the very first psychotherapeutic treatment protocol for treating patients with bipolar disorder. And as part of this work, she also came up with a book that she authored, and the book is titled A Therapist's Guide to Treating Bipolar Disorder with Hypnosis. So it will not be far-fetched for us to deal with a topic that is quite centered on her specialty. As a result of that, today's topic that we want to explore has to do with trying to understand all about bipolar disorders and how to engage in some form of treatment plan for patients who are dealing with bipolar. So Dr. Mira Duncan, welcome to Making a Difference in Mental Health Show. It's nice to have you once more on the show.
Thank you so much, Prince. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. And congratulations on your recent published book as well.
Oh, thank you. I'm grateful. Oh, so this topic is such an important topic because of how common bipolar disorder happens to be in our system. Now, can you help us to understand what bipolar disorder is all about?
Absolutely. And before I go into that, I just want to clarify a little bit of, you know, you mentioned the first psychotherapeutic treatment protocol targeted at bipolar disorder that I have created, EVSTT, but I just want to clarify, it's the first one to include clinical hypnosis. So it's definitely not the first, you know, psychotherapeutic treatment protocol that's been created, but the first to include clinical hypnotherapy.
All right, that's good.
Yeah. Okay, so basically, you know, when we discuss what is bipolar disorder, and we go a little bit into the history that for thousands of years, symptoms of depression and mania have been reported and identified by therapists and physicians, but it wasn't until the beginning of the 20th century when they finally recognized and formally labeled it. And I love Dr. Ronald Fieve's explanation. So I'm going to share his definition. He notes, some history that I like to share, like the term bipolar was actually coined in 1953 by Karl Kleist, MD, a pioneer in German neuropsychiatry. And officially, the term bipolar disorder was first used in psychiatry to make a clear division between the two opposite poles, the episodes of elated mood or mania and the episodes of major depression. Bipolar disorder is a complex genetic disorder that's characterized by dramatic or unusual mood swings between major depression and extreme elation, usually accompanied by disturbances in thinking, distortions of perception, and impairment in social functioning. The mood swings of bipolar can range from very mild to extreme and can come on gradually or even suddenly within minutes to hours. And as early as 1958, it was finally included in the DSM-1 as manic depression, finally recognized as a legitimate diagnosis. It wasn't until 1980 in the DSM-3 that it changed to bipolar affective disorder, and then 1984 in the DSM-4 that it was subdivided into bipolar 1 and 2.
I'm happy with the historical background you've given regarding bipolar disorder. And as you were giving the historical background and also trying to explain what bipolar disorder is, the fact that it also involves the two aspects where on one end you have the major depression or major depressive disorder, and then the other end you have the mania and how the two play out at the same time. Of course, interchangeably along the way. And you also mentioned something to the effect of bipolar, the type one and type two. So I would like you to focus a little more now on the types of bipolar disorders since you've already mentioned it. And how
Absolutely.
does each of them play out?
Absolutely. The two main types of bipolar are bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, as you mentioned. Patients with bipolar 1 have a history of at least one manic episode with or without any past major depressive episodes. So all they need is one manic episode that's documented. Patients with bipolar 2 have a history of at least one episode of major depression and at least one hypomanic episode. And approximately 60% of manic episodes occur immediately before a major depressive episode. People with bipolar 1 who have multiple, which is usually four or more mood episodes, whether they're depressive, manic, or hypomanic, within 1 year, receive a specifier with rapid cycling.
Okay.
And according to the most current DSM-5, bipolar disorder is characterized by recurring episodes of depression and mania or hypomania. Although most people with BD experience both extremes of mood, the DSM-5 does require only the presence of a single episode, as I mentioned earlier,
Okay.
of mania to meet the diagnosis criteria for BD type 1. And there are different subtypes, of course, of BD, and they tend to be categorized according to the duration and the intensity of the manic or hypomanic symptoms.
Okay.
Yeah, so the other types of bipolar disorder, rapid cycling bipolar disorder, cyclothymic disorder, substance-induced, medication-induced, specified bipolar and related disorder, or there's even unspecified bipolar and related disorder. However, I've only worked with bipolar 1 and bipolar 2 diagnosed clients.
Okay. So with the types of bipolar disorder you've mentioned, of course, the primary way of classifying it, which has to do with the bipolar, the type one and type two, which is a classical classification. Then, of course, you also looked at the classification based on the duration. Now, for the ordinary person, what are some of the symptoms that when they are being seen over a certain period of time, it can indicate to them that maybe their loved one or a friend is actually dealing with an undiagnosed bipolar disorder, and therefore they may have to encourage the person to seek some kind of maybe psychological assessment or something like that. What are some of the common symptoms that even ordinary people, when they see recurring, they should be a little concerned to help those who are close to them?
Absolutely. So the symptoms and features of BD vary actually quite significantly from person to person. The recently introduced DSM-5 system emphasizes a dimensional approach to diagnosis in which the different types of BD are no longer considered as separate disorders, but are rather regarded as related conditions on a continuum. So when we talk about the spectrum, with some conditions reflecting mild symptoms and others more severe symptoms. And to go into, the symptoms, we can definitely go into that. But it is, it's also significant that top researchers now believe that it affects 4.5% of the population in various forms, while others, such as Dr. Thebe, actually report 6.5% of the population, which is one in every 15 persons, has a chance of developing manic, hypomanic, or depressive episodes in a lifetime.
Okay.
And the average age of onset for bipolar 1 is 18.2 years, bipolar 2 is 20 years. Now, if we go into the symptoms, if we look at mania, the presence of full-blown mania means that an individual meets the criteria of BD type 1. So if a person is experiencing a period of abnormally high mood, in a manic episode, individuals with BD will experience an excessive sense of elation, of excitement, or irritable mood, and sometimes in conjunction with abnormally high energy levels or hyperactivity. Typically, someone can be sleeping only 3 hours a night, but have more energy than ever, not feel tired at all, which is also a great indicator for people.
Okay.
Yeah, other symptoms like of the mania would be subjective sense of one's thoughts are racing, an unstoppable flow of ideas, feelings of over-optimism, inflated self-esteem, grandiosity. Usually people will talk very quickly to the and then change topics so quickly they can make, I've had clients that would come in who have decided to start six different businesses that week. Because they're so excited and they're in a manic state. And they have the energy to do that, but of course it's not realistic. But when you hear someone that's talking so quickly, so loudly, so many ideas all at once and trying to follow through and actually really, really do all of these things each day, it's a good indicator as well. It's really
Okay.
high energy levels that we see when a client is in a manic episode.
Okay. So, in the case of the manic episode, what about if the temperament of a person predisposes the person to express a lot of emotion in terms of outbursts of emotions? And those close to the person do sometimes see the person in such hyper expression of emotions. How will they, in such context, be able to probably differentiate that from manic symptoms which are identified with bipolar, especially type 2? Sorry, especially
Absolutely.
type 1.
Absolutely. And actually, you do require at least three of the symptoms that are in the criteria. So if we look at, the changes in behavior, we need to have at least three. So if somebody is just exhibiting one symptom, it doesn't really meet the criteria to diagnose with mania, with bipolar. But if so, it would be like, they'd have to have at least three of either inflated self-esteem, grandiosity, decreased need for sleep, like we mentioned, you know, feeling completely rested and energetic after only 3 hours of sleep, definitely more talkative than usual, and pressure. They, you know, some people will feel a real pressure to just keep talking, you know, a flight of ideas that we mentioned, distractibility also can occur, increase in goal-oriented activities, you know, like we mentioned as well, excessive involvement in activities that have a high potential for painful consequences, such as buying sprees, shopping sprees, sexual indiscretions, foolish business investments. So those, you have to have at least three of those main, you know, that main criteria. Just one, it's just not, you know, wouldn't be enough for a proper diagnosis.
Okay.
And a full manic episode can emerge during antidepressant treatment as well. And if it persists, it is sufficient evidence for a manic episode, which would be the bipolar 1 diagnosis. Because antidepressant treatment, a lot of times, you know, physicians will not do a full, you know, it's usually a psychiatrist who does the full assessment. So if someone comes in and they're complaining that they are feeling depressed, the physician will typically, you know, assume unipolar depression and, you know, prescribe antidepressant treatment. And what will happen is they will definitely be affected and go into a manic or a hypomanic episode, typically manic. And so that's another indicator that the psychiatrist would definitely look at and is very telling.
Okay. So in such contexts, how does one differentiate, let's say, depressive disorder from, I'm talking of maybe major depressive disorder, from bipolar disorder, which may just be type 2? How does one differentiate clinical depression from bipolar disorder?
It's definitely different. You know, it's suggested that bipolar depression may have an increased incidence of psychosis, more mood variation, so typically feeling worse in the morning but better in the day as it progresses, increased hypersomnia, which is, you know, excessive sleeplessness, which you don't see in unipolar depression and major depression. You know, people will typically with unipolar depression tend to sleep frequently, whereas this is completely different. It's increased hypersomnia, so excessive sleeplessness with energy, and a large number of depressive episodes over time, tending to have a shorter duration, whereas that's, you know, quite different from a regular depressive state.
Okay. So that takes me to some of the psychotic aspects to bipolar disorder. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, actually, I can give an example of what one of my clients, and actually we call her Jody in my book. I did include her case study because it is quite dramatic and impactful in my book. But she did, her very first episode was psychosis. And it was actually a very traumatic experience that occurred that I believe, you know, activated those genes, those candidate genes that are actually connected and have been proven and researched to be the group of genes that are associated with bipolar disorder. So she had this fight or flight stress response after a real scare that she experienced. And right away, you know, just went into psychosis. And what she did, and it's typically, you know, we see a lot of when people are in psychosis, a state of psychosis, you know, they hallucinate, they believe they're doing something that they need to do to protect somebody or themselves. And she walked into a home where she thought strangers, you know, she didn't know this family. She walked into a home of strangers and she thought the children were in trouble. She thought the parents were the devil and that God was telling her to save the kids.
Okay.
And so it, you know, the police obviously had to be called. Luckily, the two parents remained extremely calm. They believed that her intent was not to hurt them, just to protect the kids. So they, you know, luckily they understood that something was going on, you know, emotionally with her and mentally. And yeah, the police were called, she was arrested. And that's actually the catalyst of how she was hospitalized for the first time and finally diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And okay. And it was that psychosis, that psychotic episode, which then immediately turned into mania, which is very typical. To begin with psychosis when it's bipolar one and then quickly go into mania.
So even with this instance you've given, in a case where, let's say, there is this extreme mood swings, normally in such cases, how should it be looked at?
I mean, I think it's, you know, the best thing we can do is people that around who care about that person, who notice a shift, a change, notice that, you know, the behavior has changed, notice that they are hallucinating or they are, you know, saying and believing things that don't sound rational. And, you know, definitely try to get them in for an assessment, you know, is the best thing that you can do. It's difficult when someone is in a state of psychosis, it's near impossible to convince them that what they're experiencing isn't rational. So it can be challenging to convince someone to go in for help, to either go to the hospital, which, you know, of course the best thing to do is immediately go to Emerge, and get an assessment. That's going to be the fastest way for treatment. You know, we don't know what people will do if they are in a state of psychosis. And so sometimes we do have to take them in to the hospital and have them assessed. So it's very challenging and it's very difficult, but, you know, there's not much else we can do other than trying to get them help in the moment.
Okay. So in a case where one has not been diagnosed of maybe bipolar disorder, meanwhile, that's what the person is exhibiting. Does it come with disadvantages when a person is not diagnosed and therefore the person is going about things normally in the eyes of the person involved, thinking everything is all right? Meanwhile, if the person was to be taken for diagnosis, it would have come out clearly based on the assessment that the person actually needs treatment because the diagnosis proves the person has bipolar disorder. Is there any disadvantage when a person is not diagnosed?
Absolutely. I mean, it can affect, you know, like mentioned before, whether it's bipolar one or bipolar two, it can affect every part of your life. You know, people will gamble or go on shopping sprees and lose all of their money. Once someone is diagnosed, you know, there are definitely family sessions are so important so that the family, whether it's a spouse or parents, you know, that will intervene and usually, you know, regarding just that one behavior, you know, will take all the credit cards, the bank cards, and make sure they have money for, you know, for paying all the bills. But so that if they go into a manic state, they don't lose all of their money. It can affect every part of a person's life, including, of course, relationships. You know, if you haven't been diagnosed and you're going through states of hypomania or mania or depression, it is hard for people who care about you to understand, you know, and so it can affect work, of course, you know, whether you show up on time, whether you go at all. every part of functioning is dramatically affected. And so it can be devastating on a person's life. I do want to mention, though, as far as hypomania, there are proven noted benefits that people often aren't aware of. And it's actually Dr. Ronald Fee's research that I love to quote, because he really shines a light on what he calls hypomanic advantage in his book. And he regards it to be beneficial bipolar attributes of the hypomanic state found in bipolar 2 disorder patients. He used the term hypomanic edge to refer to the advantage in the 1970s upon discovering that 50% of his bipolar 2 patients were some of the most successful high achievers in New York City. We've noted positive aspects of the hypomanic state after treating hundreds of the most elite, high-powered, gifted, and successful people in New York City who had been given bipolar 2 diagnosis and were publicly revered for their extraordinary levels of cognitive ability, creativity, passion, and high functioning. His research really expresses that with the formulation of his new concept, which he calls bipolar 2B, and the B he uses as beneficial. He published his first scientific paper in 1992 on this subtype, and he identifies the specific use of hypomanic mood as an advantageous benefit to persons with bipolar 2. So that's different, of course, than mania, where it can really impede on your life and the symptoms are severe. Hypomanic is much more mild.
Okay. I'm very happy you also did mention that normally bipolar disorder affects literally every aspect of a person's life. And you even mentioned relationships. So let's take an instance of a marriage relationship where one who is experiencing bipolar disorder is exhibiting, let's say, excessive desire for sex, which is even extramarital sex.
Yeah.
In that case, how do you see that play out?
It's almost like an addictive behavior when this occurs, even though it is a symptom of bipolar 1. It can resemble sexual addiction. And so we do see when this occurs, it's not, you know, people will sometimes at first try to satisfy this urge with their partner, but typically they can feel it doesn't feel right and they will go elsewhere. They will go outside the marriage, unfortunately, to satisfy this urge. And they're not understanding why they have this urge at the moment if they're not diagnosed. And so it can be scary and it can have dramatic effect on trust in a relationship. And actually, you know, of course, with the diagnosis, if they do finally go help because they start to exhibit more symptoms, it can be actually very calming and for the partner to understand that this is about the functioning within the neurons of the brain, the chemical imbalance that is causing this behavior. And that can actually be helpful to healing the trust issues and the betrayal within the marriage.
Okay. All right. Before we go on the break, I would like us to quickly try to explore some of the things that do cause a person who seems to have been all right going about day-to-day activities. What are some of the things that do cause a person to ultimately get to the place of being diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
Absolutely. Although the cause is not fully understood, bipolar disorder is thought to have a strong genetic component. So there's no question that bipolar disorder runs in families, and that that most of the familial risk is genetic, not environmental. And I really like to look and quote one of the leading PhD researchers of bipolar disorder, which is David Mikleowitz. He offers a clear breakdown of how stress is linked to the illness. And he talks about how we needn't think of bipolar disorder as only a brain disease or only a psychological problem. It can be both of these, and each can influence the other. Most professionals think of the cycling of bipolar disorder, and for that matter, the waxing and waning of most illnesses, as reflecting a complex interplay among genetic vulnerabilities, neurocognitive processes, psychological processes, stress agents, which is, you know, where a lot of my research really took shape and began to take form when I looked at how the candidate genes and the role of cortisol play in affecting mood and the stress response. And so so basically, you know, the strength of the signals transmitted through the spaces between the nerve cells in your brain, the synapses, is different from the people without bipolar disorder. This dysregulation is called abnormal synaptic plasticity, and it can show up in different ways. Your brain may be over or under producing certain neurotransmitters, such as dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, or GABA. You might undergo changes in structure or function of your nerve cell receptors. You may also have changes in the functioning of volume of certain brain structures, such as prefrontal cortex or the amygdala. These changes are only detectable in brain scans, though. And I like how Mikleowitz and Gitlin elaborate on stress in the course of bipolar disorder. They discuss how, despite the clear genetic nature of underlying vulnerability for bipolar disorder, it is equally clear that environmental variables such as stressors and life events are common triggers for bipolar episodes, both manias, hypomanias, and depressions. It's easy for individuals with this disorder and for clinicians to look retrospectively and always find a trigger. When events such as mood episode occur, people naturally look at their lives and find some reason why an episode occurred at that particular time. Studies with prospective ratings of life events, you know, in which recognition of life events or stressors before an episode begins really demonstrates that these life stressors are indeed more common before mood episodes.
Okay. So what about the aspect of childhood trauma and its contribution to bipolar disorder? Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. With, you know, as I said, I would like to discuss a little my research, you know, really came to be because it directly speaks to that. But definitely childhood trauma, like I believe with all of my research, you know, what I saw was there was significant childhood trauma, often sexual abuse as well. Almost all of the clients that I have seen did experience a significant experience with, you know, child abuse and sexual trauma. And I believe it, you know, it's really heavily connected to the fight or flight stress response with those genes. And what I saw was there were several occurrences that were extremely traumatic during childhood, during teenage years. And then with each and every client that I have seen, there was a dramatic stress response, fight or flight stress response, just before that very first episode, whether it was psychotic, whether it was manic, whether it was hypomanic in nature. And there's also evidence that patients with bipolar disorder who have high levels of stress and conflict within the immediate family dynamic are 5 to 6 times more likely to have reoccurrences.
Okay.
And I think, you know, I think when we look at, the automatic negative thinking people have when they've had a very painful, traumatic childhood, that distorted worldview that people carry with them in how they believe the world looks at them, how they look at the world, how they feel like they belong, who they believe they really are, which is usually tainted in trauma, definitely affects their episodes, because if you think about when a person is triggered, whether you have bipolar or not, when you are triggered by a painful experience, by a reminder of, something that was traumatic for you, right away, the first thing you do, those three stress hormones are released into your bloodstream. You go into that fight or flight. You start to get activity in the amygdala part of the brain. And right away, we look at that feedback loop where all those automatic negative thoughts that are distorted in trauma, that are never rational, that are never correct, start to come into play, and they start to think it, which only continues that cycle of anxiety, of panic. And so, with my work, part of it is starting to heal that trauma that most people do experience, on one level or another. And I find that is when we desensitize those triggers, when we reframe those incorrect negative thoughts, and start to change that painful, hurtful, judgmental worldview that so many people do have, I find that they experience episodes that are not as severe, that are less frequent, because it has an effect on future episodes when we don't go to those very damaging automatic negative thoughts.
Okay. Wow. So far, we've been discussing bipolar disorders, and we will later go into the aspect of its treatment. But Dr. Mira Duncan has been helping us a lot to understand all about bipolar disorders. She's helped us to know what it's about, the types we have, the symptoms, and some of the causes or some of the contributory factors that make a person predisposed to bipolar disorders, including risk factors and all that. When we return, we are going to take a quick 5 minutes break. When we return, we'll try to focus our attention more on the treatment part of bipolar disorders. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Everyone, welcome back to Making a Difference in Mental Health Show. We are still discussing bipolar disorder and its treatment. We've already taken a lot of time to discuss all about bipolar disorder so that we can better understand it. But this second part of our interview, we want to focus on the treatment of bipolar disorder. I'm still having a guest with me in the person of Dr. Mira Duncan. Welcome back, Dr. Mira Duncan.
Thank you, Prince.
So at this point, can you help us know some of the available treatment options for a person who is diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
Absolutely. And actually, before I go into that, I would like to talk a little bit about what the catalyst was for the treatment protocol that I created for patients with bipolar disorder, because I think it speaks directly to the question that you have regarding treatment options.
Okay.
I just want to discuss a little bit about the implications of the relationship between life events, family stressors, and bipolar moods. There have been recent advances in molecular genetics that allow researchers to examine regions of the chromosomes in an attempt to locate these genes for bipolar disorder. And of particular interest to my specific research are the candidate genes that I mentioned earlier that were identified to be linked to bipolar disorder for brain-derived neurotrophic function. which encourages the development of new brain cells, the connections between cells, and synaptic plasticity, and are believed to play a significant role in the stress response. And this is where my research, my theory of causation and treatment protocol really began to take shape. Back, you know, years ago, in case study after case study, there always seemed to be an external stressor, a traumatic event that preceded the initial episode, which was either manic, hypomanic, psychotic, or depressive, and usually occurred during the late teens or early 20s. The components of causation are strongly linked to genetics and a biological chemical imbalance in the brain, which is an alteration within the neurons and their ability to transmit. Yet it always seemed to be activated initially by a traumatic event. From all of my research, from the hundreds and hundreds of case studies I read, and from my own clinical trial, a significant flight or flight stress response. The traumatic events seemed to flip a switch in the genetic predisposed individual, activating the actual onset of the disorder that leads to the chemical changes that foster a manic, depressive, or hypomanic response. Therefore, acknowledging the role of the candidate genes that are linked to bipolar disorder and connecting the stress response, and also factoring in the proven effects of cortisol, which I know we haven't had a chance to discuss, but cortisol actually has a significant effect on mood regulation.
Okay.
And these were the catalysts of my theory. Here, my own theory of causation that linked the fight or flight stress response to the genetic and biological manifestation of this illness began to take shape, you know, which we've been discussing, environmental stress theory of causation. I identified a sort of switch that flips on, triggered by a powerful stress response that leads to the very first bipolar episode. I then began to develop a treatment protocol that focuses on the environmental stress component, the first to include, as we've mentioned, clinical hypnosis, and since coined it environmental stress targeted therapy, EDSTT. And I want to mention it's very common for patients to have anxiety comorbidity as well. It's a common diagnostic reality that affects patients with bipolar disorder. The lifetime rates of anxiety, comorbidity, and BD are extremely high. As many as 90% of individuals with bipolar 1 reported having anxiety disorder at some time. Okay. And yeah, just now looking at treatment options, the environmental stress targeted therapy has 5 stages that I developed. And it includes counseling, talk therapy, CBT, mood track charting, sleep-wake rhythm charting, interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, which is IPSRT, along with clinical hypnosis and family-focused therapy.
Okay.
And then if we look at other, we go into the other different types of treatment. You know, most of the different types of treatment, there isn't a lot that is targeted and focused and developed just for patients with bipolar disorder regarding psychotherapeutic treatment protocols. And most of the psychotherapeutic modalities are included in my 5 stages, except for DBT. So if we look first at interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, IPSRT, it was developed by Ellen Frank and her colleagues.
Okay.
And it's a combination of interpersonal psychotherapy and behavioral techniques to emphasize structured daily routines to reduce symptoms of depression and symptoms of hypomania. Specifically, this theory suggests that life can trigger disruptions in your time cues or activities that you structure your day around, such as meals, exercise, naps, or work. These disruptions in your time cues then disrupt your overall daily routine, which can cause biological changes in your body, like fluctuations in temperature, sleep, or hormone levels. It's also a key component in observing aspects of your daily routine that may be affecting daily functioning and mood. And that's part of why I do utilize it as well. because it's a great indicator of what's going on, what's causing stress, what the routine is, how much sleep a person's getting. It's a great way to kind of chart. And clients do not like to do it. They don't like to have to chart every day all everything that they're doing. So it can be very challenging and a struggle to get them on board. Typically I will just ask them to chart, you know, for a month so we can get a good idea. Because what happens then if they go into a manic state or a depressive state, or a hypomanic state during that month, we can then it can make it easier for the client to acknowledge, oh, this was the stressor. Look what happened here. And that's probably why, you know, and I went into an episode. And then it can also help with with giving them, you know, when they understand what triggers them, not only in my work with them to desensitize that trigger, but that they can be more mindful and see when they're going into an episode early on, instead of waiting until the symptoms are really affecting them to diagnose that, oh, we're in an, you know, I'm in a manic episode or I'm in a depressive episode. It can really help with early detection for an episode. So that is why I like the tracking.
Okay.
And then another, you know, which I mentioned already was the family focused therapy, which David Michlewitz and Michael Goldstein developed in 1997. And it's a skill based psychoeducational treatment modality with the ultimate goal of reducing stress and dysfunctional dynamics in the home and family environment by increasing and improving communication skills and relationship dynamics, educating the family members, and providing problem-solving training with the family environment. So these are family sessions that therapists will have with the client, utilizing, you know, basically the protocol that they developed, which is, you know, all about assisting the patient and relatives with integrating the experiences associated with episodes of bipolar disorder. Education is so key with the person who is diagnosed, and also with anyone who is close to them, loved ones, family members. When family members really understand what's going on, what the symptoms are, and what the person really needs in terms of support when they go through each episode, it can have a dramatic impact.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
And
then, of course, there's... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yes, so already you've mentioned the family-focused therapy and how even as part of what family-focused therapy can achieve, you've indicated the component of the support system that it provides, for which it assists the patients in the recovery process. You've also indicated another aspect of course, CBT and some of the other aspects of talk therapy. Then the importance of psychoeducation, you've also mentioned that one as well. Now, can you throw a little more light on how crucial the psychoeducation is? Of course, you've said it in person, but can you expatiate on that?
On what, sorry?
The psychoeducation, the role it plays in the recovery process or the treatment of the bipolar disorder.
Absolutely. And actually, there are so many, so much work that we do with clients when we look at that aspect. And it's part of my stage one that is not only assessment, but educating the client. When people understand, you know, there's so many clients that come into my office and they do not understand the symptomology of their own diagnosis. You know, the psychiatrist hasn't fully explained, or perhaps they were in shock, so they didn't absorb it. But I get so many clients who don't fully understand, you know, what every symptom is and how to work with it. how to accept it, how to deal with it. And it's so important to understand, you know, instead of self-blame and shame and guilt and judgment, which is, you know, I think the go-to for so many people, if they're different, you know, if their behavior is different than what they believe to be the norm, you know, and so it can really lift the spirit. It can really release all of those feelings of shame, of guilt, of self-judgment, when they understand, well, this is, you know, when this is occurring in my brain, when I have this chemical imbalance, these are the symptoms, and it's time to stop judging and blaming myself for it, because this is what I need to expect, and now how do I deal with it, you know? Okay. And so when families are on board, you know, a lot of times, like I said, it really helps as well with early detection, because when a client really understands what all of their triggers are, what all of their symptoms are, and why, it makes it so much easier to detect early when an episode has begun. And therefore makes it so much easier for the family to be on board. And sometimes the family, like, I'll make up sheets, you know, definitely that include all of the symptoms, because it's hard to remember everyone, you know, for each, for depressive, hypomanic, manic. And so I will make up sheets, you know, with little pictures, and give it to the family members, give it to the client, and they can put them up on the fridge. And then they know, like, if they start behaving that way or feeling this way, you know, sometimes the family member will notice first. They'll say, oh, you're talking really fast. You're starting to, you know, make a big list of all your goals. You seem to have a lot of energy. I think you're going into a manic state, you know, and then they can kind of monitor and watch, and they'll know, which is just helpful in understanding and accepting what's going on. And then, you know, can make sure that they're getting into their therapist frequently when they're struggling to deal with an episode.
Okay. Wow. So at this point, can you speak to the combined effects of medication and talk therapy in helping treat a bipolar disorder patient?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, some clients choose not to take medication. Many are on medication, and it can definitely be extremely beneficial. Then when we add in, you know, seeing a therapist and starting to work through the emotional component, that's affecting triggers, that's affecting, you know, your episodes, creating anxiety, creating sometimes panic attacks to that extent. It, you know, I really recommend that I would never diagnose, I would never, you know, suggest to a client, you know, well, you need to be taking lithium, you know, you need to do this or this or this. Yeah, what I always recommend is, it's so important to go see the psychiatrist. Let's get a full assessment. And let's, you know, sometimes clients will go 10 years without being reassessed. It's so important, you know, to every year to just go in and get reassessed as to how you're doing. Absolutely. Yeah. And it can affect, you know, they may change the dosage, they may reduce it, they may increase it, you know, according to how you're responding, how you're functioning. I think it's definitely important to lean on what the psychiatrist is really recommending. And then, you know, would I just really focus on the psychotherapeutic treatment component.
Okay. So with the antidepressants drugs and the antipsychotic drugs and all that, how, at least to the best of your knowledge, how helpful have you seen it been for patients, even as they also receive talk therapy?
Yeah, well, antidepressants, like I said, if you have bipolar 1, antidepressant will actually put you into a manic state. So it's right away they know this is bipolar 1. And if you have bipolar 1, they will typically not ever prescribe antidepressants. Sorry, what was the other part of your question?
In your years of dealing with patients who've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, how helpful have you seen antidepressant drugs and antipsychotic drugs help them on their journey to recovery?
Yeah, the antipsychotic drugs, I've only had a few patients who were on the antipsychotic, and you know, from what their assessment, from what they tell me, it has definitely had a positive impact on their lives. And you know, again, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't really, I can't speak much to that question. I don't feel like, you know, I'm trained to really answer that
That's okay.
correctly. Yeah, all I can say is just from what I've seen from the few clients that I have that have taken it and are on it, and it seemed very positive.
Okay. And can you give maybe some specific highlights as far as treatments, plan is concerned to assist therapists who happen to be handling bipolar cases? Of course, you've mentioned you've taken us through it vigorously, but just some highlights.
Yeah, I mean, I think any therapist that is working with a client with this diagnosis, you know, it is obviously aware that the very first thing that is so important to do is to listen to the client, to the client's story, to the client's experience, to educate them on what this illness is and how it affects you, and that it is not your fault. It is simply a chemical imbalance, you know, and really work through healing some of the traumatic experiences that are affecting your thoughts, you know, and identifying the triggers in each episode, the traumatic and stressful events that occurred prior to the very first episode. Desensitizing them, desensitizing the associations, you know, I think that's probably the most important part is first accepting, you know, giving a person a place to really understand and accept this diagnosis and that it's not the end of the world. You can work through it, you know, you can really start to heal as you understand this complex disorder.
Okay. Wow. In the case of, let's say, any of the types of the bipolar disorder, where the severity level probably is mild, or in another case where it's moderate, and then in the case where it's chronic or severe, to the best of your knowledge, and of course, it'll differ from patient to patient, but as far as trying to say something about how long treatment plan can sometimes take, what can you say to that? Taking into picture in the case where it's acute or mild, where it's moderate, where it's severe, sometimes how long can the treatment take?
Absolutely. In terms of my treatment protocol, it can range from 4 to 6 months of weekly sessions for the core work. We then reassess session frequency according to how well the client is doing and functioning. Sometimes we'll move to once a month. Sometimes they'll only come in as needed. But since it is a lifelong disease, it's important to have open communication once you've really done that core work with the client, continued contact, checking in with them, having the family members also let you know, reach out should the client be exhibiting challenging experiences with any future episodes. It's, you know, the family member will also reach out to me sometimes and, you know, we'll continue that work, but as it's a lifelong, you know, it really should, it should be lifelong therapy. But that doesn't, like I said, that doesn't mean once a week for your life. It can be once every month, once every 6 months, you know, a couple times a year, depending on how well the client is doing and how well they're functioning and responding to their medications.
Okay, so this is very important. The mention of bipolar disorder being a lifelong disorder, of course, it's important to note that. A patient who hears that and gets so much concern that if you are saying this lifelong, now that means I'm going to be drug dependent for the rest of my life. Is that what you want me to stay with? Then what's the use of staying and pushing and trying to work on a recovery process when you are telling me that this is lifelong? Why should I now be concerned about any treatment plan since it's lifelong? And I may end up being dependent on medication for most part of my life and also therapy. So why not just throw my hand into the air and just let whatever will be end up being the case?
Oh, because I think we all have a path. We all have a journey. We all struggle regardless of whether it's with this illness or other issues. And what we want is to heal and to enjoy life, to feel peaceful, to feel happy, to be productive, to be functioning, to be healthy. And I think, you know, this is your life, whether you're going to really focus on healing and resolving some of the emotional stress and pain that you're experiencing, or whether you choose to just, you know, it is a choice to just stay in that painful place, that dark place, where there is no hope, where, you know, that's not a life anyone wants to choose. And I think, you know, whether, like I said, not everyone does take medication, and often with bipolar two, they don't take, they're not prescribed medications. You know, often with bipolar one, they are, but it's, you know, it's up to the patient to decide whether they want medication or not. And so sometimes they will try without and just do psychotherapy, and sometimes they're fine. Sometimes they still need the medication. And what else is, you know, medication there for if not to help? You know, if there are times when we just need it. And, you know, this is about the brain. So it's important to understand that it's simply a physical issue, and then intertwined, heavily intertwined and affected by emotions, by stress. And so, you know, I mean, all I can say is there is hope, and I see significant healing and change with the clients that I work with when they also add in, you know, therapy.
Okay. I think so far this has been very helpful, but let me pass this comment so that probably you can speak to that since we are gradually getting to the end of our discussion. When it comes to alcohol intake, as well as, let's say, drug or substance abuse, can you speak to the role that alcohol intake and substance abuse plays in contributing to people sometimes ending up with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder?
Okay, yeah, it doesn't, alcohol abuse, substance abuse doesn't cause, you know, bipolar one or bipolar two. It's, it's like a behavior that, is formed when people are trying to deal with the pain that they're experiencing from episodes and they're not familiar, they haven't been diagnosed yet, often, or it's somebody who is diagnosed who is trying to escape, you know, who doesn't want to deal with it, who doesn't want to face it, and is just trying to escape that pain. But it doesn't cause bipolar 1 or 2.
Yes. So let's speak to the risk factors. One of the risk factors we know to bipolar disorder has to do with alcohol. In terms of lifestyle risk factors, alcohol and substance abuse is also part of the risk factors to the whole bipolar disorder narrative. So as far as helping with progress is concerned, how should patients be assisted to understand the negative effects of alcohol intake and then substance abuse on their recovery process?
Yeah, I think that really speaks directly to, you know, addictions work. I did originally graduate in addiction studies, so I did have a lot of formal training regarding working with patients with addictions. And it's, you know, I think they really, you know, people, when we start to unpack their experience, start to really go through what they're trying to suppress, the pain that they're trying to escape from. It comes down to working through and processing those traumatic events, usually childhood trauma, you know, that people are trying to quiet. And once we start doing that work, they start to understand how this is not helpful when dealing with, when you add on episodes, whether they're psychotic, manic, hypomanic, depressive in nature. When we add on this diagnosis of bipolar, it is, you know, has such a negative impact on healing, on functioning, on, you know, it the opposite of what they want to achieve and the goals they have in the life that they're trying to create. So very similar to work for any addictions client. But of course, you know, we talk a little bit more about how it can really affect episodes, making them worse, you know.
So at this point, can you take us through some of your works out there and how people can find you, and then your last words?
Sure. Yeah. Just, you know, I think we mentioned earlier my book, A Therapist's Guide to Treating Bipolar Disorder with Hypnosis, An Introduction to Environmental Stress Targeted Therapy. And it's available at all major bookstores worldwide. You can also read some of my articles on my website, which is thirdeyehypnotherapy.com, or read an excerpt from my book on my author's website at miraduncan.com. And of course, you can always follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook. I'm not big with social media, but I do make a tiny effort to participate. So, I think that's probably where you can find me the best.
Okay. Discussion for today has been very educative, very enlightening. It's been in-depth. And we are so grateful to you, Dr. Mira Duncan, for taking us on such a journey. I know that all our listeners out there are going to learn so much. I'm talking of both normal people who do not have any psychological training and even therapists who need more insight in order to help their patients. We are grateful to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Prince, and thank you for having me today. I really appreciate it. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Every time we've had you on the show, you've always given us so much, and I don't know how I can thank you enough, but thanks for the richness of what you always share. you always give your all to what you do. And I know that in like manner, your clients, the patients that you attend to, are going to benefit a lot from your services.
Thank you so much. That's so kind. I really appreciate it.
All right. So regards to everyone, your daughter, the family, and hope to be in touch in the course of this year.
Absolutely. Sounds good. I actually have 3 children, but they're all grown up. Yeah, they're all grown up.
Okay. I remember your daughter who helped with the setup,
the sound interference. She's a filmmaker, and so she lives in Toronto, so that's why I called her quickly while we were on a break. So we're having so much sound interference, what do I do? And she was very helpful. So I'm working from the office today, so luckily we haven't heard any sound interference on my end. Have you had any?
No, it's been perfect. It's been perfect.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you so much. So
yeah, you're welcome.
I really wish you all the best for the month. Of course, we are about to enter into a new month. I wish you all the best for the new month of April.
Thank you. You as well.
Okay. Do well to enjoy the rest of the week.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I trust you have learned something new today too. Don't hesitate to use the knowledge you've acquired by listening to this podcast to help either yourself or someone get the appropriate professional help. Do well to share this information and podcast with someone, and that's how together we'll make a difference as far as the mental health of people around us is concerned. Thanks for joining me in today's episode on the topic, Understanding Bipolar Disorder and How to Treat It. Join me twice a week as we delve into other topics geared towards making a difference in your own mental health. Find me on all social media platforms with the name Counselor Prince of Fay or Counselor Prince and Associates Consult. And make sure to subscribe, like, and comment on any podcast app. Thank you. Have a sound and healthy week.